Our next session is all about the education revolution. So, I mean, all industries are being inundated with data. There's new techniques all the time. There's better processing power these days. And the one thing that I found personally to be quite challenging is just with new techniques coming up, just new data sources, new way to actually process data, how do we actually keep being educated? How do we keep being at the forefront of data science? And the session is all about formal and informal ways of actually educating ourselves. Our first speaker is Michael Storojev. I hope I've got it right. Michael is an actuary with a passion for data analytics innovation in the actuarial and general insurance fields. He is the senior underwriter for travel insurance at Covermore Travel Insurance, where he pushes the confines of a traditional actuary, pioneering things like Python, machine learning, and the AWS framework, to leverage technology in pricing, underwriting, distribution, and product development. Prior to Covermore, Michael had broad general insurance experience at RACQ and IAG, where he was involved in pricing, reserving, and capital management in a number of short and long-tailed lines of business, and enjoys seeing the value that actuaries can bring to the wider business context. Our second speaker is Dr. Daron Samuel. Dr. Samuel is a fellow of the Royal Australian and New Zealand Colleges of Psychiatrists. He's also a graduate of Harvard Business School and a graduate from the London School of Economics, where he completed a Master's of Behavioral Economics. He is presently enrolled in Sydney University Business School, where he's doing a PhD on the impact of personality on insurance risks. He holds several appointments, including Chief Medical Officer at Zurich Insurance, Strategic Advisor to AMP, Chief Medical Officer of Allianz Life Insurance. He also owns and operates his own businesses, Professional Opinions, a medical risk management company providing assessment services through a panel of 400 medical specialists, as well as Behavior.ai, an international behavioral economics consultancy. Dr. Samuel has recently prepared a draft mental health charter to create a framework for general insurers to meet their obligations on discrimination in mental health, and is currently working on a new approaches to mental health underwriting, using behavioral economics to increase insurance retention and modeling the impact of legislative changes for CTP insurers. Welcome, Michael. Come on.
The field of data science has been seeing quite a rapid transformation in the last 5 or so years. It goes beyond just the change in title from big data to data science to data analytics, and goes further than affecting the roles of just us technicians, actuaries, and data specialists at a few companies. We've actually seen quite clear and valuable benefits to the entire economy from the value of data science. Just have to look at industries such as the whole internet advertising bidding system to realize that how reliant it is on data, on artificial intelligence and automation that didn't exist a decade ago. New existing industries are bracing for the impact of all the insurtech, fintech, regtech, and any other type of tech that's utilizing new ways of using data and finding new processes. And most companies are finding new and better use for their existing data with a clear mandate from the top to improve in this field. And all of that means that there are exciting prospects for actuaries, technicians, and IT professionals to come to this space. But at the same time has left the industry reeling with how to fill a talent shortage that is estimated by McKinsey & Co. to be 1.5 million jobs globally next year. Now, this session is named the Education Revolution, not because I think we need an overall overhaul of everything that works well at the moment. I like this title because it brings the focus back on us. It is about giving ourselves as industry professionals a mandate to try and fill this skill gap. But as I'm sure we'll all know, universities, the Actuarial Institute, and the industry all have a role to play to recognise that there needs to be a different way to think about how we train talent to fill this skill shortage. Traditionally, we've established our qualifications with degrees or certifications, and that's not the only way. I recently heard a great analogy that tries to describe this by looking at woodworking. So imagine you want a custom kitchen cabinet installed, and you invite some carpenters to come and talk to you about it. One comes to you and shows you a certificate saying, I've apprenticed with the most famous cabinet maker in the city for the last 7 years. The second one shows you her toolbox, opens it up and says, these are the newest chisels, and no one has a sharper plane. The third one comes to you, gives you a small box, perfectly smooth, intricately designed, and the drawer opens smoothly, silently, and says, I made this last week. Now, I'm not saying one way is a better way than the others to decide who you would want to hire, but all of these three ways, certifications, tools, and portfolios, are ways of establishing credentials, and all have their relevant place. From a traditional certification standpoint, most universities in Australia have created or adapted programs to cater to fill this need. Findamasters.com, which is a website that facilitates course selection and comparison, suggests that there are 93 individual postgraduate data science options in Australia available right now, ranging from masters, some research degrees, graduate certificates, at most of the major universities in Australia. But is this enough? And will any of these degrees be enough to single-handedly fill the job shortage? Now, I started looking into most of these degrees. I was interested myself, trying to see what might help me in my journey. And what I found was that all of them are very, very different. They vary in structure, in time. You can have a one-year master's, you can have a three-year graduate course. And when you look at the courses that they offer, they're all very different. They're usually taken from quite a wide range of faculties, specialties, including mathematics, statistics, as you would expect, IT. But then they would also have quite a big range in other departments such as finance, economics, even biosciences and visual design. And seeing such a wide range of degree options suggests to me that no one has really found the magic bullet to solve the problem single-handedly. No one really knows exactly what the industry is after. And the industry kind of, I think, is in the same point at the moment. I'm sure all of us that have looked up what is a data scientist will come up with the following graphic. And looking around, there's a huge amount of different topics that an employer expects a data scientist to cover. But what the main thing we see is that it is not just about deep learning or just about recurrent neural networks or big data or any other buzzword that is making the rounds at the moment. It is a true synergy of fields and disciplines. And so when seeing such a range of expectations from this role, it's kind of no surprise that the industry still sees the true data scientist as a bit of a unicorn. However, to me, it's encouraging that both the industry and academia are starting to adapt to realizing what needs to happen and that the data science role is does need to rapidly evolve to meet the needs of the industry. From an industry perspective, looking at, say, what recruiters that specialize in the data science field are looking for, we're starting to see that there's a bit of a niche area coming through in terms of data science recruitment. So this was an example that I pulled up recently from a company called Mongo Solutions, which say that they specialize in data science recruitment, but they're showing just how different some of these roles that they're looking for can differ and give you a tool to assess your capabilities, experiences and interests. And so you kind of see that there's a very big range between just a technologist who's trying to push technology into the companies that the companies can use compared to a modeler, which kind of, as an actuary, it aligns more to my expectations. But also you have more of those that are focused on communication. How do you put together the correct visualizations and graphics, and how do you communicate that to a broader market? As actuaries, I think we've probably been exposed to a lot of these different things. So it's for us, it's kind of a great niche to get involved in. And as we just saw from Paul, that there is a lot of collaboration between universities and both the public and private sector on projects. And we'll hear from Dr. Doran Samuels about some of the work that he's done in partnership with Sydney University, and that's not it's not unique. It's great to hear that there's a lot more understanding from academia about these roles need to adapt to what the industry needs. But when we look at, data science is still really in the infancy stage of developing what we want it to be. And so because of that, I feel that tools and portfolio are also some of the more powerful ways of demonstrating what your value can be to a prospective employer. But you need a degree of self-sufficiency for this. How do you start to build your intricate boxes to show to employers? Or how do you find the correct chisels and planes to use? And the problem is that looking around, there are far too many options. You just need to search data science study into Google to give you hundreds, if not thousands, of different options to choose from. And it can be overwhelming. And so how do you sift through all this and decide what is useful? Which of these topics should be tackled first? And if you remember back to the diagram about what a data scientist is, they are very different topics. And also, how much depth should you go into? Do you want to spend the next 3 years drilling down into Hadoop, becoming an expert in it, and then in 3 years' time when you're looking for work, realizing that the industry has moved on, evolved, using different platforms or tools? It's all about finding the right combination of what you want to take to an employer. And so my suggestion would be to talk to people that have gone through such a journey. I know it sounds obvious, but that's how everyone that I've talked to that have started a journey like this really have started. They talk to people they know, they talk to colleagues, and if that fails, look at a few public examples. So this was one which I used for inspiration from Chris Alban, who's a data scientist with a PhD who then, after finishing his studies, wanted to go even further and improve his machine learning and data science skills with a summer challenge whilst in the industry and working. Now, if you go through it, his list of aims was quite ambitious, including 100 hours of video lectures, reading 20 books, and then also creating material. So not just consuming it, but to prove his knowledge, 500 tutorials. And his machine learning flashcards are actually quite good, so they're available now as well. And then, of course, stuff that we all should be doing anyway. But he did all this in 4 months. And when I start looking at examples like this, for me, it shows there's really no excuse. We should all be trying to do more ourselves. And when you start thinking about it, 100 hours of video lectures, it's doable. I live in Western Sydney. I've got about an hour commute every day. We start adding that up. That's 10 hours a week. Most people suggest when you're looking at lectures, maybe speed it up a bit, 1.5, 1.25 times speed. That gives you about 12.5, 15 hours of lectures that you can look through every week. And with a 5-month-old baby at home, the train trip is really the only time I have to myself to do anything like this. So it's actually, when I get into it, I find it amazing how much you can go through in a week. One of these courses is between 10 and 15 hours of lectures at most, so you can do that. it's not too hard. A more intense example over the course of a year comes from Bill Kilmer, who was the chief insights officer at a US food service distributor. And over that 1 year, he undertook 29 online courses and read 25 books. And the good thing is, if you go to his website, which is down there somewhere, Dreaming of Data, he's actually got write-ups of all of the courses that he's done. So it creates a great resource for people that are interested to decide what might be relevant to them to focus their attentions on first. Now, these are just two examples that I used for inspiration, but there are plenty of others. Just having a look at what other people's journeys are really help you understanding what you can do in the time that you've got. But it's also very easy to go down a rabbit hole, so just be careful. And that's why I say, talk to people that you know that have gone through this. Really helps. And recognizing that not everyone here is kind of starting out in the industry, looking at the more senior people in the room, there's also a great deal of help that employers can play for this purpose as well. In one of my early roles, I was actually very surprised when my manager told me in one of our first one-on-ones that he expects all his staff to spend 10 to 15% of their time on independent research, on getting new techniques. This was a typically actuarial pricing role, but I was told, do what you think is interesting. Do what you think will not only help your career, but will help the team, and present on it every now and again once you find it. And that was really the start of my personal journey. I got involved in Python, I got involved in R. I started trying to see if I could do multi-threading on RPCs to improve efficiencies. And that sort of those sorts of techniques ended up helping me both in that role, but also taking it to find new and different ways of thinking about data and the actual process in other roles. So once you have those tools, I think the key thing is to make sure that you can showcase that you've got an ability to use those techniques in a real-life challenge. You need practical ways of showcasing this knowledge, and I really strongly support looking at projects, practicals, challenges, competitions, hackathons, anything you can get involved in that use real data. Now, the Institute hosts an annual Kaggle competition, which I recommend everyone to get involved in, but it's not the only platform. And there's a huge variety of competitions and data that you can access to analyze and practice your new techniques. So imagine going to a prospective employer and being able to show that you understand the limitations and the complexities of telemetrics data. Then, well, there's a competition that looks at race data and race telemetrics data from MotoGP. Or the other quite interesting one of being able to classify military photography from the Data Science Challenge, which is a UK initiative that, for one of its purposes, crowdsources techniques for the MI6. So these are using real-world data with quite interesting business problems that we can all access and can all participate in. And there's hundreds of competitions like this. And the important thing is that we don't really need to win these. So, when you look at the people that do come top of the leaderboard, that's their life for a few months. They have a team of 3-4 people, and the models kind of go a bit overboard at times, I think. But it gives you a chance to really get your hands dirty with real data. And they're not necessarily all structured, perfectly tidy, perfectly usable data. There's still a lot there that needs to be done to put it in a format that can really be analyzed properly. And if you want to take the next step, find your own data. As a personal example, I was house hunting for about a year, and we didn't really know what we wanted at all. But there was one criteria that we knew for certain, and that was my wife could not stand the idea of living next to power lines. So I couldn't find a single data set out there that could help me other than going to the house, seeing that there's any sort of power lines in the background, and not buying the house. So put together my own data set. It was a deep learning exercise, and now it was a lot easier to get to that. Ended up evolving into a quite interesting value, how much does house value change as a result of power lines exercise, but that was a side project as a result of it. And one of my colleagues ended up looking at 4020s. He had no idea about what NRL was, but he tried to see if there was a way to game the betting market through a 4020 GLM analysis, built a great model, spent the entire summer this year doing it, went to the first week of the NRL season, and then realized that the betting market had closed. So it happens. But the main thing I wanted to kind of leave you with is that we really need you, we really want everyone to, it comes down to self-sufficiency. So the Institute does have quite a few ways that it gets involved, and there's a data analytics working group that looks at, to build community. One of the key initiatives that it started recently was about getting more members involved, and so that's kind of kicked off with the Young Data Analytics Working Group. But one of the key points that we are looking at is to try to put together what are the capabilities that need to that actuaries need to build up to for to become successful in this sort of field. And so there is a lot of work being done at looking at what a syllabus would need to look like. And so I'm really excited to kind of see what happens with that. And Jenny this morning did say that there's a lot of collaboration from a global space to make sure that actuaries are well positioned in this field. So there's a lot of exciting things to happen. But the main thing that I want to leave you with is that don't be scared. The data scientist is not this incredible role that gets all the fun things to do at every company. As Michael Rice said, actuaries really are the cream of the crop. We know how to bring all the different disciplines needed to provide advice to employers. Not just a model, not just a number, but advice. And I found this recently. This was from a statistician conference. But the top one is what really sits with me quite nicely. A data scientist is a statistician who lives in San Francisco. So there's more than that to it, but don't be scared of them. Well, we have the same techniques. We know what needs to be done. Just go out and do something. So.
That's great. And Michael, that was very interesting. And we should all congratulate Covermore for being one of the first travel insurers to lift their blanket ban on mental health cover. And that's made a very big difference, and it helped propel a lot of the other insurers to do similarly. And I'm sorry that I wasn't able to stay to be here for Paul's talk, because Dr. Paul may have identified the number of people who are washing their hands, but it's my role as a behavioural economist to actually get them to wash their hands. So that's the sort of thing that I do. So today I'm going to talk about my personal education revolution. But you probably have heard all actuarial jokes, have you? You have. Should I dare actually tell one? That the difference between an actuary and a mafia don, have you all heard that? The actuary knows how many people are going to die, but the mafia don knows their names. Okay. So how do I do this here? Okay. So when I think about revolutions, I think about the thing that happened with Sigmund Freud. I've got to make a psychiatry reference since I'm a psychiatrist. When he was approached by the communists trying to get his support for communism, and they explained to him that in the beginning there'd be a lot of bloodshed and killing and disruption, but after that there'd be peace and utopia. And he said, and they said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, I believe half of that. I believe the first half." So I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about where I'm coming from first. You heard that very lengthy introduction about myself. I'd be a little bit embarrassed about that. But I've studied at quite a few different institutions, as you can see. And we are living in a time of a lot of opportunity. But I think that I just have a cautionary word to say about that opportunity. And that technology has the potential for an able-bodied runner to run very far in the wrong direction also. unless you get the philosophical understanding, unless you actually understand the data, understand the problems, the technology is not going to get you to the solutions and can in fact be extremely misleading. So that's one of the things that I think is probably underemphasized when it comes to data science. It's not just the tools. I found some of this out myself when I was doing. All of you probably use Jupyter notebooks and things like that. And I was running an analysis of the NES ARC3 data set. Are any of you familiar with that? It's one of the biggest epidemiological data sets from the United States. And I was looking at the criteria that could predict post-traumatic stress disorder. And when I ran some machine learning algorithms, I found that the most important predictive factor was the unique identifier of the participant of the study. And then you hear other anecdotal stories about people doing these analyses, and they come up with this fantastic thing. Oh my God, prostate cancer. The most important thing in determining whether you're going to get prostate cancer is whether you're a male. So I think we have to always be mindful of what our purpose is. And our purpose is to get a better understanding, not just to come up with some, not just necessarily a spurious correlation, but we want a deeper understanding of what it is that we're dealing with. So I want to talk about, my emphasis is on research. As the person introducing me said, I've got my own companies, which fortunately allows me to feed myself. But half of my time is spent research, doing doctoral research at Sydney University, which is a fantastic university, and they're thinking of doing an actuarial course. I think that too much of the time we're engaged in a utilitarian sort of approach to life. And if any of you read the book Who Moved My Cheese? Yeah. So Who Moved My Cheese, in summary, is all about finding cheese and eating cheese, and then suddenly the cheese goes and you think, wow, what do I do? But as my Harvard professor of negotiations, Deepak Malhotra, he wrote a response called I Moved Your Cheese. And you read it? Yes, you read it? It's a fantastic book to read. Because life is more than just about getting cheese. And I think that a lot of the time when we're just focused on the cheese, we're missing the picture. And I was glad to hear, Michael, what you said too about one of your employers saying that you should be spending time thinking and not just doing. And I think paradoxically, when we're doing that thinking, we actually end up finding more cheese or creating more cheese. I think that when we are doing more research, my experience has been that there are tremendous spillover impacts on the businesses we're working at. And because it's not just about the research itself, but people learn to be more disciplined in their approach to understanding things. When it comes to insurance, particularly in the areas where I've been involved, whether it's life insurance or CTP, there is really not a lot of very good research out there. If you look at Google Scholar, would people agree with that at all? Some of the studies that I'm currently writing up, I'm looking for references. It's like there are hardly any in these areas. So there are so many opportunities for us to get a better understanding. And when we don't have an understanding, it makes us vulnerable. It makes us vulnerable to competitors, to shareholders, to regulators, to customers. And so there's a lot that we should be very motivated to do research. And these are the things that actually propel me. And I'd encourage you and the companies that you work for to see research as an opportunity to demonstrate your integrity, to be progressive and evidence-based in your approach. And I think that when we do that, you'll get much better outcomes rather than some of the gestures that some companies do sometimes in what I think is just virtue signaling. So I want to tell you about some of the research I'm currently doing, and then I'll focus on some of those specifically and what my experience has been. So as the person introduced me said that I've studied at LSE, and I've got a particular interest in honesty and underwriting, and I'll go into that in a bit more detail and about the impact that that's had, and also looking at, in fact, the impact of advisors in life insurance on the honesty of recipients, fascinating findings, and also on customer retention. I'm looking at a study at the moment with a CTP insurer about the impact of regulations, and I think it touches a bit on something that Paul said about fraud. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. You work in the CTP area, some of you? No? So the government, New South Wales government's changed the regulations to try to separate out major from non-major impacts of motor vehicle accidents with the hope of containing some of the costs. But in my mind, it's been fairly poorly conceived. And what they've done to try to distinguish those things is to focus on diagnoses, particularly in psychiatry. Now, my hypothesis is that with the regulation, it's going to change the diagnostic practices of the doctors. And if we can demonstrate that, then it opens a whole can of worms about how regulation and legislation changes medical behaviour, which in my mind is very disturbing. But we need to get the evidence for that to then drive the legislation. That's one of the things that I'm interested in. As I mentioned before about the mental health underwriting, you'd all know that there was a very big test case with QBE and it put the focus on travel insurers starkly into light. And now it's the time most of the travel insurers have agreed, because I'm a strategic advisor through the Insurance Council of Australia, to collaborate with the data, if the ACCC will allow us, to look at the impact of mental health cover for those travel products. Another thing that I'm doing is data. I'm looking at building a real-time quantitative model for mental health underwriting, which I'm going to touch on a little bit later. But my pride and joy that I'm doing my doctoral research on is the quantification and modelling of personality as a predictive risk factor for insurance products. And this, I'm going to go on in a bit more detail, just time willing. And so what drives me is that there's an enormous personal pleasure in the curiosity of discovering new knowledge. And I think that, I think this is sustainable. I'm probably the oldest doctoral student at Sydney University. They made a special allowance for me. But the thing is, coming from industry rather than just being an academic brings real problems into the academic world and creates new opportunities rather than academia driving it. We need, as an industry, we need to be driving some of the research and solutions. So this was something that I did for my master's at LSC, behavioural economics and underwriting. And the thing is, I've got a couple of acronyms there. That's false negative self-disclosure and false positive self-disclosure. Now, the thing is, if I ask you, do we have a problem with adverse selection? Would you all agree that we do with underwriting, particularly like with life? Would anyone disagree with that? I'll take your silence as agreement. But do we know the extent of the adverse selection if it does exist? So that's a problem, because often we're only examining claims to see whether there's been a non-disclosure or an incorrect disclosure at claims. So we don't know what's happening with the rest of the people. So for my dissertation, I triangulated the Australian Bureau of Statistics data against the aggregated company data to look at what I predicted the disclosure should be, normalised for socioeconomic status, and against what was being disclosed at underwriting. And this, you can see that the insured population is in, I'm colourblind, so if I get this wrong, please don't laugh at me, or you can laugh at me, I don't mind. It's red for the insured population, that looks like blue for the general population. You need to do these kinds of things before you can go to the next step of trying to correct it. Because unless you're doing this, you can't do your power analysis and work out exactly how many people you need to do a study to actually improve it. So this comes down to what I was saying before, that you need to understand these fundamentals. It's not just about understanding how machine learning works and Jupyter Notebooks work. You need to know what the increment you're expecting with your research to be able to show that it was statistically significant. So that to me is a very big gap, and you could imagine if you modelled it, if those disclosures were elevated, what the implications would be, either be increase in revenue or you could disaggregate the risk, for people who are non-smokers. There are lots of possibilities. But so I went for approach of triangulating data. So this comes back to what I was saying before about doing a power analysis. I see a lot of behavioural economics that doesn't use this, what I think is a rigorous approach, but needs to. To determine how many people you need in a sample to do a study. And I'll just briefly touch on the outcomes, because the dependent variable in that study was smoking. And you can see that with one of the treatments, that for women in particular, using a loss aversion approach, we increased smoking disclosures without any other impact by 150%, which is just phenomenal. And then when you look at some of the other potentially dependent variables, this is a bit small for me, things like mental health disclosures, for some people that was increased by 22%, illicit substance use disclosures, 56%, alcohol increased, people's weights increased, women got shorter, all sorts of things happened. The Australian Bureau of Statistics is a fantastic way of triangulating some of these things. And one of the things I'm looking at the moment is with illicit substance use. Does anyone know what the lifetime incidence in Australia of illicit substance use is? Can anyone have a guess? Next. You said 5%. We must know the different people. Anyone else? 60? Closer. It's 42%. I'll put you out of your misery. 42%. If you look at the underwriting disclosures, particularly on life, for instance, do you see anything like 42%? Just not at all. So there's something that's happening that's not right there, but we know what it should be. We also know what it should be for, say, mental health, for depression in the previous 12 months. It should be around 20%, but we're not getting those kinds of disclosures. So that's what I'm doing with the behavioural economics. So the potential impact, increased revenue, increased market share, combination of the two. And what I'd say about this sort of research, and I'd encourage you to message this back if you're not already doing it yourself, is that this kind of research is low cost, well, generally speaking. It's low operational disruption. We didn't have any complaints at all, and the rewards are very high. So it really is a no-brainer, I think, to do this. Looking at the mental health and underwriting, and I've just taken a couple of screenshots of what I'm doing there on a Python notebook. So you can see that I've tried to model what I try to do here is try to identify by criteria whether I can predict if someone's going to get post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, admittedly, the data set had so many features, there were like 4,000 features per entry, that you can't reproduce it necessarily for a typical life underwriting situation. But I just wanted to predict, and I could predict, that the model fitted the data 99%. Which is just enormous. And you can see with the confusion matrix there that the true negatives were extremely high and the true positives were extremely high. The false negative and false positives were extremely low. Now, what this will allow us to do ultimately is we will be able to model the features that people give us at underwriting and predict quite precisely what their odds ratios are for developing certain mental health conditions. And rather than just going plus 50%, plus 100%, we can actually give the accurate risk across the portfolio for these kind of applicants. And so these are the features importance, and you can see that they're all quite low, like the biggest is 0.05, and I think that was the unique identifier. So just for your amusement. So I've got a little video that I made, which I'd like to show. Are we able to roll it? If I go to this one. Sydney University is great. They have their own media studio in the business school, and in fact, the actor that I used was the technician in the media studio who did not actually want to do it, but I just placed in there. He was very generous in allowing me to do it. Boyd, thank you. Is there sound with it? You know where this is from?
Say hello to Kevin and Kev. Kevin and Kev both want disability insurance. They are both age 42, married, and have 2.2 children.
That was a joke.
They are both senior administrators in private companies. When filling out their insurance applications, they answer the questions in exactly the same way. They have the same job classification, live in the same suburb. They do not smoke. They consume 5 units of alcohol per week. They do not engage in extreme sports, do not use illicit substances, and have had no major operations. They have had no time off work for medical reasons. The insurance company evaluates them as being at an identical risk for disability. Both are offered standard disability insurance contracts, costing $200 per month. Both accept the contracts. 12 months after the policy commenced, both Kevin and Kev had heart attacks. The heart attacks were of equal severity. Kev spent 3 days in hospital and commenced cardiac rehabilitation. So did Kevin. 2 weeks after the heart attack, Kev returned to work. 3 months later, he was working normally. Kevin, however, worried every time he felt something unusual in his body. He attended his doctor every second day. He thought he would never recover and that death was inevitable. There was no way that Kevin was returning to work, ever. Could these outcomes have been predicted?
I've got a bit of a tickle in my throat. I may go home early, but I'm sure I'll be back tomorrow. My throat is sore. I heard that that can be the first sign of throat cancer. I'll be off for a few days, as I may need to see an ENT and get tested.
Kev has a well-balanced personality. Kevin is a catastrophizer. Had the insurer known that personality could reliably predict risk of disability, what impact would this have had?
Thank you. So, to me, this is one of the holy grails because I think it's true that people can look exactly the same risk on paper, but they behave vastly differently. Can we actually capture their personality? And one of the things that I'm doing in conjunction with IBM is using their Watson platform to convert conversation into text, text into personality insights, and then extract the personality insights as variables and put them into the data set and regress them against the various outcomes. So whether those outcomes are claims, declinatures, fraud, whatever else, but with enough data over time, we should be able to make sense of that. Now, it may not work the first time, but I'm confident that we will crack that relationship between personality and risk. So I just finishing off, I would encourage you to work with universities where you have the opportunity. The IP issues, the confidentiality and ethical issues can all be very readily resolved. Do any of you know how much the quantum of the how much does it cost the university to produce one high impact paper? Do any of you know, have an idea? They say, if I've heard a lie, I'm telling a lie. But at a recent conference at Sydney University, they said it was about $450,000 per paper. So that's what you're getting when you're joining into a collaboration. And there are a lot of industry sponsors for PhD students, and this is my pitch for Sydney, that anywhere between $15,000 and $30,000 per year, which is nothing, is it right, for your companies, to get some of the youngest, other than myself, and brightest doctoral students working on your hardest problems for over a 3-year commitment. That really, to me, is a no-brainer. And I'd encourage you, if you're interested in that, I can put you in contact with the various people at university. I think that it's an opportunity for us to embrace the problems, embrace the challenges, and to be guided by the results of that research. So I put some contact details if anyone wants to speak to me afterwards about any of these things, but I think Michael and I are now open for questions.
Thank you. The floor is open for questions. I might start first. Dr. Samuels, you obviously know a lot about behavioral economics, and I was lucky enough a few months ago to actually hire someone with a behavioral economics background. And to be honest, I've never seen anyone be such a compliment to a data science team. The types of hypotheses they came up with, which forms the basis of most projects, is quite, it was incredible. What value do you see in incorporating something like behavioral economics into a data science education module?
Thank you for that question. That was an excellent question. And please look at my website, my sensational consultants who are doing behavioural economics. Perhaps I should reflect back on some of what I learned at the LSE. And one of the strongest units I think we had was philosophy. And I mentioned this problem a little bit earlier. It's not just about being able to crunch the numbers, it's being able to understand the problem and about getting insights into behaviour through which you can use the technology to then see whether to test those insights. Because the behavioural economics, even though Richard Taylor just got the Nobel Prize, it's still in its infancy. And there are a lot of fancy theories, but they all require to be tested in your specific context. So I think the hypothesis testing, the scientific framework, getting it to a position where it's reliable, I think it is an excellent marriage, particularly if you've got someone in behavioural economics who has an understanding of both the quantitative and the qualitative aspects of the research, or the problem. Yeah.
Thanks. There's a question.
So I was talking to Michael at lunch, telling him about my interest in behavioral economics. So quite a coincidence listening to your talk. One of my key interests is behavioral economics and behavioral nudges, how you can augment behavioral nudges with data science predictive models. Essentially, an example would be identifying fraud and maybe using behavioral economics to come up with nudges to identify your high risk of fraudulent activities, mm-hmm. and nudging them not to commit that fraud. So I wanted to understand your perspectives on how effective they are and how can it really augment data science models.
Okay. I'm sorry, Michael, I'm monopolizing the answers. But it's a very, very good question. Behavioural economics is being increasingly used, whether it's by the ATO or other financial institutions and government bodies to improve people's behaviours. The way I like to put it is we can help people meet their obligations that they're not currently meeting. And you saw with the smoking, it definitely did that, because how else could you explain that people said they didn't smoke in the control group and they did smoke in the treatment group? That is a fraud, because it's the way you ask the question. It's a pretty simple question. Have you ever smoked? You know the answer. So yes, so we looked at some of the potential theories, whether it was loss aversion, social norms. Like for instance, for illicit substance use, something that I'm looking at the moment, not personally, is that if you preface the question by saying 42% of Australians have used illicit substance at some time in their life, have you? You're probably more likely to say yes than if you just ask it and be like, oh, should I say? What do they want to know? What are the consequences? So the context of the questions, I think, can definitely shift people in the right direction. But you do need to know how far you can shift them. That's why I wanted to know how many people had used them, so I know what to expect from the outcomes. Otherwise, you don't know where you're going. And that's why I wanted to know how many people had smoked for exactly the same reason. And when I measured people's heights and weights, which I didn't go through in detail, I also looked at I did a last digit analysis of people's heights and weights, and we say to people, give us your exact height and weight. But then when I did a frequency analysis, I got lots of people's weights ending in 0 and 5, and same with their heights. That's a fraud too. It's a softer sort of fraud, but you have to know what you're aiming at. So yes, I think there's a huge potential, and it's a soft approach. It's not a heavy-handed approach, very potentially effective, but it has to be done by trial and error to know what's really effective for your customers.
Any other questions?
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm working from SKL. I just have one simple question for Michael. So I work in the actuarial recruitment space, and I came across many actuarial professionals who are quite interested in the data science area. And lots of them just come to me and say, oh, I don't know what to do. So I really want to give them some good advice. And with your comments, what do you think is the biggest area that actuaries need to build up on or improve on in order to be, you know, successful in the data science field?
So I think actuaries are a great addition to any company due to the fundamental approach to advice. So we need to, it's part of our inherent training to ensure that we understand the business context, we understand the tools that are required, what the client or the company needs, and then provide them with concrete advice. I think the major bit that we do need to understand and do need to develop in is maybe the technical stage. So we're all very technical people, but at the same time, it's just speaking that same data science language. It's realizing that the same techniques that we can use in insurance pricing can be used for other models. The talk on NRL was, I think, a great one. It was a GLM that the model was based on that most of us would have studied about, but we know how to present it in a different way, know how to apply it to different industries. And I think just understanding what kind of techniques are out there. We don't need to know all of them, but just need to know the scope that these techniques can, what employers are used to seeing, will really help with kind of showing that we would be able to hit the ground running in any data science role.
Do we have time for one more question?
Question for you, Dr. Samuel, around kind of the prediction of mental health for claimants, and kind of harking back to one of the earlier points, I think, in the first presentation, that really the difficulty is in finding new sources of data. If you're existing customers or clients, however you name them, and I'm just curious as to whether the work you were talking about has, whether you've seen that go through to application where organisations or companies are managing to collect that new source of data about the people they interact with?
That's a very good question. Thank you very much. It's a huge problem. And part of the problem is that the prevalence of mental health conditions is just so high. And the definition keeps on changing. So as every iteration of the American Psychiatric Association or ICD-10 version comes out, the prevalence goes up. But that's just the prevalence of impairment. It's not the prevalence of disability, and that's the disability is what we're interested in. Because there'll be customers who are getting sick and not claiming, but we don't know much about them. So this is where the deficiency of the research is, and what makes it hard to predict who of those who are impaired are actually going to become disabled. And that's where my research is really, I think, quite critical, because there'll be someone who is sick who is not going to be disabled because they're sick, and then the person who doesn't have very much who is very disabled by it. And we see with life insurance a lot. As compared as in a clinical practice, what I consider to be severe, someone who's going to be hospitalised, compulsorily getting ECT, things like that, is that what we're seeing with life insurance claimants? Not so much. We're seeing very clinically mild conditions having very high disability. So it's hard to extract a meaning from that without looking at the whole data set. It'd be a selection bias just to be looking at the claimants without separating those who are not claiming. We need to do more research on people, on our customers. We need to know our customers better who are not claiming. And that's where we're stuck at the moment, I think.
Thanks a lot. I think that's it. I just want you all to thank you, Dr. Samuels and Michael. And we have some cheap wine for you.